Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With Tuesday marking the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, we begin with an examination of the principal proponent and architect of that war, Dick Cheney, who is the subject of a new Showtime documentary, The World According to Dick Cheney. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff in the first George W. Bush term, joins us to discuss how Bush's presidency was staffed, then captured from within by Cheney, who deceived and manipulated Bush, leading to today's bitter estrangement between the two. Then we'll examine the banking meltdown in Cyprus that has revived concerns about the viability of the Eurozone. Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute, joins us to discuss how a tax imposed on bank deposits in Cyprus in return for an EU bailout has backfired, with furious depositors threatening a run on the banks that have been closed until Thursday. We will also look into the exposure Russian companies and individuals have in troubled banks in Cyprus, where banking assets are 8 times the size of the country's economy. Then finally, we will speak with Edward France, a presidential historian at the University of Indianapolis and author of The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy. We will discuss the autopsy report issued Monday by the Republican National Committee that described the Republicans as scary, narrow-minded, out of touch, and the party of stuffy old men. Joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And the documentary, the Showtime documentary, The World According to Dick Cheney, shows a man who is in his own world. He's serene, confident, and has no regrets, no doubts, and is in, I think, in denial. However, are we in Dick Cheney's world? That's my problem.
Let me say, first of all, that in October 2005, I came out and talked about a secret cabal, indicating, of course, that there was more than one person in it. I think this Showtime documentary, which was basically a one-man show, illustrates I was wrong. The cabal was Dick Cheney. I'm sure there were other people who helped and aided and abetted him, but it seems to me, if he's telling the truth in that documentary, he was not just president of the United States for security and foreign policy. He was president of the United States for almost everything that happened. So the cabal was one person, Dick Cheney. Aiming at your question, I'm truly concerned that there are lots of people out there who, on various issues which he has broached, actually agree with him. For example, recent polls show that the percentage of Americans who believe that torture has some utility, especially in national security situations, has risen from around 51% to 61%. So clearly, the answer to your question is yes, there is some resonance with the kinds of things that he brings out with the American people, which is kind of alarming.
But what about how the American people feel about the Iraq War? Surely, given that a recent study from Brown University says that 189,000 people died from causes directly related to that war, including 6,650 members of the U.S. Armed Forces and at least 123,000 to 134,000 Iraqi civilians at an estimated cost to the U.S. taxpayer of at least $2.1 trillion. Nobody thinks that, I don't think, that Iraq was a great success. And frankly, my understanding is that there's going to be another Iraq war soon when Syria falls, and that will be the catalyst that completely unravels Iraq itself.
Now you're back to a different point, I think, and I think you're on to something. I think you're right. I was just out in Oklahoma, for example, speaking to a group. And by the way, Oklahoma is the only state of the 50 states in which every single precinct voted for Mitt Romney. So I was in the heart of red meat country, as it were. And what I found out there was an extraordinary war weariness. They're sick and tired of America defining itself by war and by the military instrument. And second, the fiscal irresponsibility of these wars. That is to say, as you indicated, the trillions of dollars that we've dumped down the drain. These issues concern even what is basically a red state. So, yes, there is deep concern over what the United States did with regard to Iraq and increasing concern over what we're doing in Afghanistan. Both situations seem to be money drains and seem to be leading to no real ends.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the Chief of Staff to the former United States Secretary of State Colin Powell in the first Bush term. Now, it was clear to me from the documentary, and it's, to some extent I had a feeling for this, but it came out so much more clearly in this documentary. But first of all, when the Florida recount was going on, and I guess George W. Bush himself was sort of in a state of confusion or in a kind of holding pattern, Dick Cheney, the vice president, was busily building a government. He went around and recruited everybody. They were his people. They owed him. And George W. Bush literally walked into a White House that was completely captured by Cheney from day one. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding. I think that's absolutely true. I also think that Dick Cheney engineered himself into being the head of George Bush's vice presidential search committee. And then, of course, engineered himself into being, the person that committee found to be vice president. Dick Cheney is a bureaucratic entrepreneur of the first order. Dick Cheney put a network in the Bush administration, including John Bolton at the State Department, I'm sorry to say, that could then answer to him come hell or high water. And they did so. They had a vision. They had a strategy for implementing that vision, and they were utterly ruthless in carrying out that strategy. And frankly, they beat the hell out of the rest of us for at least 3 years until we finally wised up to what they were doing.
But how did he manage to get his own National Security Council? What was Condoleezza Rice doing?
Good question. She certainly wasn't managing the decision-making process, which is the first job of the National Security Advisor. She was getting closer and closer to the president so she could keep her eyes on the prize, which, of course, in the second term was her being elevated to being Secretary of State. In defense of her, though, I don't see how she could have probably taken any other tack other than perhaps resignation, because she was up against the vice president and the Secretary of Defense and sometimes the president, because they were so successful, particularly Cheney, in convincing the president of their views. As Richard Haass has said in his book, Cheney always got the last bite of the apple and usually alone in the Oval Office. So she was up against a fairly formidable duo in Rumsfeld and Cheney, and often trio with the president having been talked into their point of view. So managing the decision-making process was extremely difficult, and she simply voted not to do it and more or less became one of those who goes along to get along.
Well, that sounds like, my understanding of the principal job of the National Security Advisor is to protect the president even from himself. And if it was more about future ambition than the fundamental job, she was a manifest failure. Is that too unfair?
I don't see any other way to judge her time as National Security Advisor. I don't think it was all her fault, but
right.
I think she was, in that position, dysfunctional. I remember vividly coming in to see the Deputy Secretary of State one day, Rich Armitage, and him pronouncing the decision process as dysfunctional to me. He didn't need to do that because I already knew it was dysfunctional. And there are a number of reasons why a process like that becomes dysfunctional. It can be the president. It can be the National Security Advisor himself or herself. It can be the cabinet officers. In this case, I think it was a combination of Condi just not having the chutzpah and the president being utterly naive in most cases, not steeped in anything much in the way of international or security policy, and therefore being easily persuaded by the last person who got to him, which was usually the vice president. So in that sense, there was no adult supervision for the entire cabinet, and certainly no adult supervision and backup for the National Security Advisor.
So it seems from the documentary that George W. Bush finally sort of woke up towards the end of his first term, particularly over the incident where the Attorney General was about to have an operation and he signed over his authorities to the Deputy Attorney General Comey, and Cheney and company were trying to get them to reauthorize a wiretap surveillance regime that the director of the FBI, as well as the top people in justice, thought was illegal. And they were about to resign en masse. The president knew nothing about this. Cheney was telling him completely everything was just because Comey was being a difficult guy. And eventually, I believe Comey finally let the president know what's going on. And the president realized that just before his reelection, he would have had a Saturday night massacre with the entire Justice Department and head of the FBI quitting, and that would have tanked his chances of being reelected. So is that the wake-up call, the first big wake-up call?
Well, I think it was, and I think the second one comes just before and results in November, as I recall, of 2006, his firing Donald Rumsfeld. And that was when, essentially through indirect advice from his military commanders in theater, and from others around him, he understood just how badly Rumsfeld had managed the conflict in Iraq, and so finally got rid of him. I'm also told that that started a fairly significant breach between the vice president and the president that sort of ended with President Bush's refusal, even though Cheney begged him, literally, if you can imagine Cheney begging, the president to fully pardon Scooter Libby, who was, as you may recall, convicted of obstruction of justice in the Valerie Plame case. And the president refused to do so. And I'm told Cheney left in a rage, and I'm not even sure he's spoken to the president, the former president, since then.
Hey, and the president, apparently, towards the end, wouldn't take his calls, didn't want to see him. But right. One of the things that was really disturbing about getting into the Iraq War, and I think in Bush's own biography, autobiography, didn't he say that had he known that there were weapons of mass destruction, he would not have gone to war? But Dick Cheney lying to Dick Armey, I thought, was really shocking. That Dick Armey is for all of his flaws, is an old-fashioned Republican that wanted some evidence and didn't think Saddam Hussein was worth the lives of Americans and didn't believe until Cheney basically snowed him.
True. I think that's all true. And look at the domestic scene, too. Here's Cheney, who runs over to the Congress, which should be unconstitutional, and caucuses with the Congress. Here's the Vice President of the United States colluding with his party in the Congress in order to, for example, get tax cuts passed that the president didn't want, knowing full well that if the Congress packaged those tax cuts in a piece of legislation that offered the president other things that he did want, the president wouldn't veto it, knowing the president's predilection to non-veto. And this president really did not like vetoing legislation. So Cheney goes over, caucuses with the Congress, gets the things in the bill, gets enough into the bill that he knows the president will like those things in the bill and won't veto it, and gets what he wants passed and never tells the president anything about it. This is all revealed, of course, at least in some aspects, in Bart Gellman's book, The Angler.
Right, and the on the attack of 2000 of 9/11, apparently Dick Cheney did not inform the president about the shoot down of the plane that eventually crashed in Pennsylvania.
The archives, Ian, on this incident probably won't be out for historians and others to look out for years, just like so many things that are classified or have moratoria placed on them. I think we're going to see, when we do see all the archives and we understand everything that transpired on that day, we're going to see a vice president who, first of all, was utterly frightened to death. He didn't know what the heck was coming at him. He didn't know what was happening. And most of all, he feared that he and his president were going to be impeached because of what had just happened. Second, after he recovered and began to take some control of what was going on, all kinds of lying went on. They lied to the 9/11 Commission. The Air Force lied to the 9/11 Commission. Cheney lied. All manner of people were telling lies, essentially trying to cover their asses for what had happened on 9/11. The third thing we're going to find is that when they did recover and understood that the American people were not going to impeach them, they then used 9/11 as a catalyst, as an accelerator, if you will, for putting in motion what they wanted to do in the first place, the lead element of which was war with Iraq.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I'm sorry I have to leave you. I know you've got to talk with Rachel Maddow, but it's always good to talk to you, and let's catch up again.
Surely. Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is the former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the banking meltdown in Cyprus and the implications for the Eurozone.
I learned a good way. You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Money makes the world go round. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
Is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who's the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress, was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress, and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council Subcouncil on Capital Allocation. He was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this banking crisis now in Cyprus, first of all, Cyprus, with a population of a little over a million people, apparently have banking assets that are eight times the size of the country's economy, which I believe is something like $25 billion a year in GDP. So how does that compare, say, to Iceland? Is this a similar situation to what happened in Iceland, where you had foreign deposits that were far exceeded this tiny island country? In the case of Iceland, I believe the population is even under half a million.
There are some comparisons that one can draw with Iceland, but I think that the case with Cyprus is the tax rate was very low, and it was possible to attract deposits, especially from Russia and the Middle East. So clearly it was not that they were paying a lot of money. There is a lot of allegations that most of the deposits were from Russian oligarchs, that they were actually laundering money, which is not certainly has been verified. But even if you are to assume this, you know, this is falls under the purview of monetary policy. Monetary policy is supposed to be independent. So applying sort of a tax or what I might call a confiscating property is something which is unheard of and raises a lot of questions. I'm not too sure whether Berlin or Brussels actually had given a lot of thought, or even the IMF. And it seems that because of the repercussions that we see in terms of the markets all over, not only in Frankfurt and in Europe, but also in the U.S. and also in Asia, there is the question of contagion. you're quite correct when you said that Cyprus is a very small island with a very small GDP. That's probably 0.2% or 0.3% of the Eurozone GDP. But the question is really contagion. Even though many people might not know really where Cyprus is, nevertheless, the contagion is a serious event, which I'm not sure that it was taken into consideration, or at least it wasn't priced correctly in terms of what the risk was when you're making that decision, that you will tax to whatever extent all deposits, which means that what one considered a guarantee of deposits, the whole idea of deposit guarantee and insurance is now out of the window. The question would be, what would we see if we see anything happening in Spain, in Italy, or even in Greece or elsewhere? It's not really clear whether the countries in the periphery that seem to be running into trouble in meeting the targets of, as they said, by Troika, would be actually let free, and not this tool, which new tool that's been used by Berlin and Brussels, would not be used. So, just to give you an example, in Spain, you know, there are almost 3 trillion deposits, 3 trillion euro deposits. Think about what will happen if there is a bank run. We are looking for actually a complete dissolution of the Eurozone.
Well, let's try and sort of go through the steps then of how this situation evolved in Cyprus and why Cyprus is key at this point. This is all to do with a bank tax, a one-time levy imposed on the banks in order to get a 10 billion euro bailout from the EU and IMF. And the assumption is if Cyprus doesn't get this 10 billion euro bailout, that it really could go under and therefore have to leave the Eurozone. So that's what I understand is at stake. So first question is, how did Cyprus get into this problem in the first place? My understanding is that the banks in particular were carrying too much Greek debt. Is that right?
Correct. So this was a decision which was made by the Troika, that is the IMF, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, to have a haircut for the private sector holdings of the Greek sovereign debt. So the Greek banks, the Cypriot banks, were holding a sufficient amount, significant amount of that debt. So when you get a 50% par value or 71% in terms of present value haircut, that is a significant hit for that the banking sector has to absorb. And it's not possible to absorb it, especially in a small island like Cyprus, with, as you said, a very small GDP. So the question is that they were forced to take this haircut from somebody else. You know, it was not really their decision, and they had no choice in the matter. And if you were to consider in terms of the numbers, you know, 17 billion euros, it's really a drop in the bucket, as opposed to what it is they have extended to Greece, what they have extended to Ireland, what they have extended to Spain and Portugal, and what they might actually extend to others that were running to a problem. So to allow, or at least to enforce, that they will have to raise 5.7 billion euros from small depositors and large depositors, I think is unconscionable and I think unethical.
In order to get 10 billion euros as a bailout, right?
In order to get 10 billion euros. So in other words, to bail out other decisions that they were made, not really from the small depositors have to pay for this. This is really unconscionable.
But surely this kind of a tax, isn't that sort of, it's very troubling, I think, to savers. I mean, first of all, I can't see any economic wisdom in punishing savers, people who save. And it seems to be against all the fundamental principles of professional investing that the shareholders and bondholders, not the depositors, should be feeling the pain of a bank failure. I mean, that I find extraordinary, that you're punishing the depositors and not the shareholders and the bank and the bondholders.
Well, you know, they're not bondholders. That's the unfortunate thing, that the Cypriot banks do not have any outstanding bonds, so they're not bondholders. And I think that in terms of the shareholders, not really a lot to make a difference, because the banks were insolvent to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So the 10 billion or the 17 billion, the total package that was supposed to come to actually capitalize the banks. So what you are trying to do is to capitalize the banks by taking the money of the small depositors, and in exchange you tell them that you will give them shares of the banks. I mean, this is ridiculous. And therefore, the question you also said, I want to point out, that this is a one-time affair. But it's not really clear that it's a one-time affair.
Well, in the meantime, of course, since this announcement was made, Cypriots are furiously going to their ATMs, and the banks have run out of money. And so the banks have been closed until Thursday. And the vote, of course, is Tuesday, is it not, in the Parliament about what they're going to do?
That is correct. The vote is on Tuesday. My suspicion is that the vote somehow it will go through, because they will change some of the tax rates in some ways that will make it more progressive. But still, I'm not sure how much money will be left in these banks, because people already have been saying that once this thing starts, it's a slippery slope. And therefore, why would anybody leave his or her money into the Cypriot banks? And why, you know, this should not have a contagion effect in the Greek banks or in the other banks, as I indicated earlier, which means that we're looking for a substantial change in landscape. If now what one considered to be a sacred type of an asset is no longer sacred. I mean, what does it mean to have a 100,000 euro for argument's sake insured? What does it doesn't mean anything, really. Because anyone can decide that this 6% could become 10%, could be 12%. If things become very difficult, then of course there's no limit to what the charge would be, and from whom you will actually levy that charge.
And that, of course, is that this one-off tax, which you're suggesting may not entirely be a one-off tax, is 6.75% on savings up to 100,000 euros. That's basically $130,000. And above that, it is anybody holding more than that, sums greater than that threshold, would pay 9.9%. Now,
Now they're talking about changing it, perhaps that between 100,000 to 500,000, where the 500,000 and over could be 15%. You know, we would never dream of doing the same thing in Luxembourg. Luxembourg has a huge financial sector. It doesn't produce very much. You know, this is really what the economy is. We have a similar thing in Switzerland. We never dream of doing such a thing in Luxembourg, which is part of the Eurozone.
So
what happens if there is a bank run there?
Well, but what's going to happen? First of all, you mentioned the suspicions that the enormous amount of Russian deposits there have to do with money laundering, although it's not been proven. Putin, of course, has come out very angrily about this plan, because presumably all of these Russian deposits are going to have to pay 9.9% on the billions that are there, right?
That's correct. But, you know, to make a decision and say that we're actually doing it in order to punish the Cypriot banks that are accepting perhaps money that is not legitimate, that's not really the business of the Eurogroup. There is a business of a different kind, of regulation. You need to have regulation, and you need to have supervision. You know, when you have a Eurozone that is made up of 17 different countries, and you tell them that it is their responsibility to supervise and to organize their regulatory structure of the banking sector, you should expect that things like that will happen. If you had a pan-European structure of supervision and regulation, then these things wouldn't happen. Not that you will have a safe valve, you know, it doesn't happen, because we saw it happen with HSBC, one of the largest banks, that actually was caught actually doing the same type of thing about money laundering. And that was proven, that's why they paid a huge penalty. But
And nobody went to jail, by the way.
So in order to say that, you know, we're going to penalize this, the Cypriot banks because they were accepting deposits from Russian oligarchs, that's not really the appropriate thing to do. That's not their business to do it. Not that it's a good thing that what they were doing, but that's not really how you fund the bailout, by having a bail-in of the smaller depositors. That's not really how it should happen. And what we see now is, of course, Putin saying this is unfair. But on the other hand, he wants the names of the depositors because he wants to tax them too, which is a good thing that he's doing. But on the other hand, that shouldn't actually be at the expense of Cyprus, that even though it's a small country, could actually be the trigger of dissolution not only of the Eurozone, but perhaps of the European Union. So one has to wonder, what was the European Union for? You know, was it really a customs union to basically help Germany to export and therefore to make it easier for them? Or is it, you know, something bigger and something what the brains of Mitterrand and Herbert Kohl had in mind that unfortunately Angela Merkel doesn't?
Well, but I'm puzzled, Dimitri Papadimitriou, again, president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy, professor of economics at Bard College. I'm puzzled if this whole exercise is about making the banks in Cyprus more solvent, then what's to stop these Russian depositors, these oligarchs, et cetera, of taking the money out? I mean, is that going to happen?
It doesn't stop them. I don't think it's going to happen because I'm not sure if indeed there are no legitimate funds. They have very few places to transfer them. But ultimately, they will transfer them. I'm sure they will find other tax havens to be able to park those funds, which will have serious repercussions for that country. It won't happen immediately because it's very difficult to move them, to transfer these funds. But it will happen. They won't leave it there because if they have gotten the sense, which I think it was very, very clear, that they really want to tax them, and originally the idea was to tax them at 40%, this is what Mr. Schäuble's idea was as it was reported, then if you were a Russian oligarch, why would you give your money there?
Exactly. But I mean, at this point, what I understand, the people, I don't know what the Russian oligarchs are doing behind the scenes, but the people in the street in Cyprus have been holding up banners blaming Germany for the bailout deal. And of course, the Germans are saying, no, you know, it's not us, it's the Cypriot government and the European Commission and the ECB, the European Central Bank, that decided on this one-time tax. So, what's your understanding
it's always easy to blame somebody else. In the initial hours of Saturday, it was reported that this whole idea was actually hatched by the IMF, but then it was Mr. Schäuble who started putting the numbers together.
Who is Mr. Schäuble?
Mr. Schäuble is the finance minister of Germany.
Of Germany, that's what I thought,
And therefore, he started putting the numbers and came up with the 5.7 billion euros that need to be made up somehow. He probably didn't suggest that the 6% be taken by the small depositors, but he was talking about the 40% tax which is significant amounts of money. This is not, you know, you have to think about what the repercussions would be if indeed this was to happen, and if you were really targeting the Russian oligarchs.
Well, as it stands now, the banks have closed till Thursday. The ATMs have run out of money, and the vote is tomorrow. So if the vote tomorrow, I mean, aren't they caught between a rock and a hard place? They've got to get the bailout, otherwise they really will default and leave the euro. Isn't that?
Oh, I'm sure that they will pass some kind of a bill with some different, perhaps, percentages, more progressive taxation, tax rates, as you call them, tax rates. But I think this is not going to stop a bank run when the banks open, which now the banks won't open until Thursday. The banks will be closed tomorrow, and will also be closed on Wednesday. So when banks open on Thursday, we will see what's happening. My suspicion is that there will be a continuous bank run.
And a run to where? Because these are euros. Are they denominated Cypriot euros like the Greek?
No, they're euros. But you know, people will keep them. Will keep them in their homes. They won't keep them in the banks. This is what's happening in Spain. This is what's happening in Greece as well. People are worried, and therefore they keep money in whatever, you know, the proverbial sort of under the mattress, which creates difficulties in terms of the money in circulation. Because not all countries like the U.S. is advanced in terms of using technology to pay bills and do the kinds of things that we're accustomed doing here. So the problems we have not seen yet.
But my understanding is that each country has a even though the euro is a common currency, they're Spanish euros and they're German euros, and people in Greece, for example, have been changing Greek euros into German euros. Is that not happening?
That's not true. No.
Euros
are all the same.
So it's all the same, and
exactly.
And essentially, they're just stuffing them under the mattress, and we don't know on Thursday what's going to happen.
I mean, wouldn't you do the same thing if you were hit with a tax? Why would you think that somehow or other this is not going to happen again?
Right. Well, also, why would you keep your money in there? Because it's going to be taxed. If you pull it out, it won't. I mean, it's not exactly a brilliant scheme that they've come up with.
That's exactly.
And do you think that, just in closing, that they were really trying to stick that to the Russians? Is that what's going on here?
I think there's some of that.
Yeah. Sounds like it, doesn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, they're against all kinds of things that Russia is doing for energy.
Right.
They were against sort of the new pipeline that they were creating.
Right.
So I'm not surprised at all that they were actually attempting to teach them a lesson. But in the meantime, they are creating a problem for themselves.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dmitry Papadimitriou. Again, I've been speaking with Dmitry Papadimitriou, who's the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's testified to the United States Senate and House of Representatives Committees on the U.S. Congress, and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress, and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council Subcouncil on Capital Allocation, and was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Republican Party's own report, its own autopsy, that says that the Republican Party is scary, narrow-minded, out of touch, and a party of stuffy old men.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Oh,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his latest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward France.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And on Monday, the Republican National Committee released an autopsy report, and it's called Growth and Opportunity Project. And it basically, I guess the headlines are that it describes the Republican Party as having a party that is scary, narrow-minded, out of touch, and that we're a party of stuffy old men. Those are the headlines, but it seems to me that there's a lot of deeper reasons, which I'd like to go into with you. But what's your sense of this reckoning, this soul-searching that's going on?
Well, I think there's still very much a question of which direction the party might go, which of many directions. And at least, you know, you have the kind of the Rand Paul types with the libertarian angle, and then you get some of these others, the Reince Priebuses, and then you get the Karl Rove types, and all of whom are trying to call themselves true Republicans. And I think their real problem is that they're also trying to define both Republicanism and conservatism simultaneously. I think that gets them in a lot of trouble.
So what does Republicanism mean today?
That is a question that they would be better able to answer, because it means so many different things depending on where you are. Certainly looking at what, say, Ted Cruz, who was giving the keynote at CPAC, was saying, it still means very limited government and fiscal responsibility. Beyond that, there are so many different iterations, it's a little bit hard to figure out exactly how the party wants to brand itself with a simple, pithy answer to a question that should be straightforward, I think.
But isn't there a huge contradiction, and indeed it could end up splitting the party, when you've got people like Rand Paul, who won the straw poll at CPAC, as his father had done previously,
right,
where he's basically saying, we're out of touch, we're covered in moss. And he's, on the one hand, has the same message as Ted Cruz on limited government, but on the other hand, he's basically saying he has the opposite attitude to most traditional Republicans on all the social issues and on some important foreign policy issues like the war on drugs and war in general.
Yes. I mean, I think from what I saw from headlines, and again, I didn't get to see the entirety of the Priebus sort of state of the RNC, but on the headlines, it made it look as if he's saying we need to go beyond being the party of Reagan as well. And I mean, I think the Republican Party has been able to paper over some real differences by being united on social issues heretofore, which they seem to have less consensus about than at any time in most people's recent memory. And the quote that I didn't see attributed to the person I would think one would want to identify with if one were a Republican, I didn't see a lot of talk of with malice toward none and charity for all, evoking Abraham Lincoln and evoking the party of Lincoln. And I would think that would be a way to make an appeal that could get them in a direction that, for those who want to go in that way, get them in a direction that would be more appealing.
Well, but that contradicts, doesn't it, Edward France? It contradicts your book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, in as much as the Republican Party has become a Southern party, and President Lincoln is an anathema to the Southerners.
Well, the interesting thing with Lincoln himself is, of course, in the 19th century, you got a number of Southerners saying, if only he had lived, he would have been more sympathetic to us. And I think, as much as my book describes a process in which the Republican Party distanced itself from African Americans, what I found in the period from the end of Reconstruction in 1877, really through 1933, that the Republican Party was of two minds. And some could take a very cynical read on what presidents did when they went to the South during that time period, which was basically gesture towards the legacy of the Republican Party when it came to what I call the legacy of liberation stemming from the Civil War, while also making efforts to reach out to the white South. But I would argue, Ian, that they were, especially early on, whether it was Rutherford B. Hayes or somebody like Benjamin Harrison, to extent William McKinley, that they honestly thought that they could do both, that there was room for both within the Republican Party. That is, for African Americans, white Southerners, as well as Northern Republicans, to all belong to the same party. That didn't happen, but what I'm struck by is in that time period, there was still this idea that the party had to acknowledge its past, and it was an expansive past, a time when the Republican Party was not the party of limited government, but quite the opposite. That's the real history of the Republican Party. It's not a party of limited government. If you talk about when the Republican Party came into power and what it did, it was a party of expansive government. So that's the part that I find fascinating.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward France, who's a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his latest book is The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, now out in paperback. And we're talking about Monday's release of the RNC's, the Republican National Committee's report, Growth and Opportunity Project, which is an autopsy on where the party stands and how it's going to find a way to win back the presidency. One of the things, of course, they've offered up in this report is a $10 million minority outreach program to promote the GOP brand in local communities. Again, this feels to me kind of like a corporate approach. You know, if an oil company has a spill, their first priority is not necessarily to clean up the spill, but to go on television and tell everybody how much they care about the environment. And I feel like so much of what they're talking about here is a public relations way around some deep and inherent problems.
I agree with you. You know, I think traditionally when Republicans would talk about minority outreach, that would be something that was specifically African American, and they spent years courting the likes of J.C. Watt, Michael Steele, Kenneth Blackwell of Ohio, who was always looked at as a key black conservative. I think that was part of the appeal of Herman Cain. But those folks are really few and far between. And I think they're trying to make that pivot towards Latinos, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio being foremost among them. But I agree with you. It's a little hard to just point to the people who are at the top of the pyramid and tell the average person that we've got plenty of room for people just like you, especially on local government. And keeping in mind that I'm also here in Indiana. I'm not in the South. I'm not in some other places. But it's hard for the Republican Party in this state, for instance, or any of the neighboring states, to really point to meaningful minority outreach to any minority where they're really like they've got kind of young, active party members who are Latino, who are African American, who are going to make the appeals that they're interested in doing. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how that $10 million, how it would be spent, isn't it?
Well, I think, though, that when you consider the deep doctrinal differences at the heart of the Republican Party, which are, I think, similar to what's going on in the Vatican between the hierarchy and particularly the nuns, there's a similar situation here, which we've talked about, how the Rand Pauls and the Libertarian wing, which is growing, and think it's the only part of the party that's growing, particularly attracting young Republicans, how it completely takes the opposite tack on almost all the social issues, which are really the red lines for social conservatives in the Republican Party. And then within that battle, you've got the other battle that you alluded to between Karl Rove and Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh, the entertainment talk show wing, if you will, of the Republican Party. And it's hard to know who's up and who's down. I know who's got the biggest megaphone.
Right. That's why they're already looking to 2016. It's just so hard to see who ends up being the standard bearer and in what direction that takes the party, because I think most observers who've seen more of Paul Ryan don't think that that's quite ready to go presidential just yet, although he would certainly like to. And so there's not a clear sense of leadership. I think you're right about that. And there are a lot of shouters, as you said, who have a lot of influence, but they're not going to be the standard bearers for the party. And it always is a little bit awkward when you have somebody who's hardly conservative in almost any definition of the word, like Donald Trump, being invited to your events and excluding other Republicans because they're not conservative. That just speaks to me as being a recipe for disaster, at least short term.
But in terms of what Republicans believe today and what their core beliefs, leaving aside principles, that's where I find it quite alarming. And Jeb Bush at CPAC alluded to this when he said we're anti-everything, including anti-science, which I think was an important statement to make. The nature of so much of that party that is anti-science, so vehemently anti-Obama, based upon insanities like the Bertha conspiracy, that he's a Kenyan Muslim in disguise, the creationism, most of these beliefs I think are shared by the same group. I'm not sure how big that constituency is, but it's pretty clear to me that that's an important constituency in the Republican primaries.
Yeah, I agree. And so here's another illusion. In my book, In the Door of Hope, you don't have a George Wallace-type figure who's really lighting populist fires among that group, but you're almost really looking for a new or that element of folks, the birthers, everything that you just alluded to, is really looking for a kind of populist leader to take them in a kind of George Wallace direction. And they thought they had that in Sarah Palin, right? She turned out not to be that. And to make a comparison to somebody and say they're no George Wallace, usually in most cases would be something that people would take favorably. But I think in terms of political acumen and skill, Sarah Palin did not have the skills that George Wallace did of actually building a broader coalition across the country that had a lot of those same problems with establishment America that were at the core of his message in 1964 and 1968 that I think a lot of folks that you talked about there, I think that's where a lot of their sentiment is too.
But that was a time Nixon was terrified of Wallace, of splitting the party. The time it's happened since then is Ross Perot, and of course Ross Perot helped elect Bill Clinton.
Right. So it was bad for the party. Yeah, absolutely. But I think right now those folks don't have somebody to hitch their wagon to. And when they're absent of that person, they're kind of just default Republicans right now whose passions aren't being channeled. They're the ones who want to be active, and it poses a real problem for a party that wants to be taken seriously, because most of the issues that you alluded to are ones that the business conservatives have no interest in touching. So I think if you're asking me again about this gulf among various constituencies within the Republican Party, it is wide. It is hard to remember a time when that gulf seemed wider. And as a historian, I'm always more comfortable looking in the past than in the future. But at this moment, it is hard for me to see which figure is going to be able to pull those various groups together.
Well, Edward France, again, presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis and the author of The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy. I guess to some extent, the good news in this report from the Republican National Committee released on Monday, an autopsy, if you will, on where the party stands. The report says the GOP today is the tale of two parties. One of them, the gubernatorial wing, is growing and successful. The other, the federal wing, is increasingly marginalizing itself. And unless changes are made, it will be increasingly difficult for Republicans to win another presidential election in the near future. That's a pretty blunt assessment. I think a pretty accurate one, isn't it?
I'd say it's very accurate. I think if you look at much more in-depth pieces and looking at who shapes local government. There, the Republican Party is pretty healthy. In states like the one I live in, Indiana, you really have Republican control of most of that apparatus. Majorities here in both the Assembly and the Senate, and a Republican, newly elected Republican governor, majority of congressmen who are Republican. There are a lot of states that look that way, but they don't offer enough electoral votes to add up to get your total over the top. In the Hayes days, in my book, it was always, you know, the magical number of 270. The math doesn't favor them there. And so that is a problem. And that's why I think you saw more than a few attempts or suggestions that we should do away with the Electoral College coming from the mouths of Republicans this time around, because it is hard to imagine the calculus working out for Republicans to be very competitive in this current climate. They can be healthy and be very healthy on the state level. And I think also you could imagine a time in which the House remains pretty safely Republican for a pretty long period of time, just because so many of those districts are so heavily Republican. But it does not help them on the presidential ticket.
Well, just in closing, back to the social issues which are dividing them between the libertarian wing and the traditional family values wing. Senator Rob Portman, of course, coming out saying that his son is gay and his change of heart. Apparently that's being greeted in the party, but it's not going to make any difference that in terms of their policies. It seems to me hardly an accident that on the same day that this report comes out, Hillary Clinton announces that she's for same-sex marriage, which is a surefire indication she's running for president, right?
Yeah, it would certainly look that way. And, you know, it's been interesting. I can't say that I've tracked down every quotation on the Rob Portman situation. But I think to some degree, he just gets a pass on it because it's a family member. And it takes, actually, I would argue, a lot of the clout away from the statement. I mean, I think it was always the one issue that even somebody like Dick Cheney preferred not to talk about because he had a gay daughter. And I think most people, even people who weren't fans of Dick Cheney, kind of agreed not to engage him on that point. So I think he gets kind of a pass, and then Hillary Clinton coming out. I don't know why, if you're retired from the job as Secretary of State and taking time off to rest, you would issue a statement like that unless you wanted to keep yourself politically viable, correct?
Exactly. Well, Edward France, I thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Ian. Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward France, who's a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries. And his latest book is The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, now out in paperback. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.